Dan had a new sense that time was swiftly running out, a growing urgency. Hofritz had set some terrible engine in motion, and it would crush many more people soon unless it was understood, located, and stopped. Regine was lying to him, and he couldn't allow that. He had to find some answers, quickly, before he was too late, to help Melanie. Chapter 24. They retreated from the flour and dirt-strewn kitchen, but Laura felt no safer. One weirdness had followed another since they had come home that afternoon. First, Melanie had awakened from her nap, screaming in terror, clawing and punching herself as if she were a penitent religious fanatic, scourging the devil from her flesh. Then the radio had come to life, followed by the whirlwind that had burst through the back door. If someone had told her that the house was haunted, she would not have scoffed. Apparently, the move from kitchen to living room didn't make Earl feel any safer. He shushed Laura when she tried to talk. He led her and Melanie into the study, found a pad of paper and a pen in the desk drawer, and quickly scribbled a message. Baffled by his mysterious behavior, Laura stood beside him and read what he wrote. "We're leaving the house." Laura wasn't reluctant to comply. She vividly remembered the warning that had been delivered to them through the radio. It was coming. The flower-filled whirlwind had seemed to be another warning with the same message. It was coming. It wanted Melanie. And it knew where they were. Earl wrote more. "Pack a suitcase for yourself and one for Melanie." Evidently, he was prepared to believe that someone had planted listening devices in the house. Apparently, he also believed he might not be able to spirit Laura and Melanie away if the listeners knew that they planned to leave. That made sense. Whoever had financed Dylan and Hofritz would want to know where Melanie was at all times, so they would eventually have a chance to either kill her or snatch her away. And the FBI would want to know where she was at all times, so they would be able to nab the people who tried to nab Melanie. Unless it was the FBI that wanted her in the first place. Laura had that trapped-in-a-nightmare feeling again. Maybe everyone in the world wasn't out to get them, but it sure seemed that way. Worse, it wasn't only someone out to get them, it was something. Hide, that was all they could do right now. They had to go where no one could follow or find them. Laura grabbed the pencil and wrote, "Where will we go?" "Later," he said softly. "Now we've got to hurry." It was coming. In the bedroom, he helped Laura pack two suitcases, one for Melanie and one for herself. It was coming. And the fact that she didn't know what it was, that she even felt slightly foolish for believing it existed in the first place, did nothing whatsoever to alleviate her fear of it. When the bags were packed, when they had their coats on, Laura repeatedly called Pepper. The cat wouldn't respond to her, and a quick tour of the house didn't turn it up anywhere. Pepper was hiding, being difficult, as any self-respecting cat would have been in those circumstances. "Leave it," Earl whispered. "Someone can stop by to feed it tomorrow." They went through the laundry room into the garage. They didn't switch off any lights behind them because that might have signaled their intentions. Earl put the suitcases in the trunk of Laura's blue Honda. She didn't need to ask why they were taking her car instead of his. His was parked outside at the curb. And if those FBI agents across the street saw Laura and Melanie heading for it, they'd want to know where they were going and why. They might even prevent them from leaving. Of course, their hurried flight might be a mistake because the FBI might want nothing more than to help. Or it might not. In either case, their best hope was to trust only in Earl Benton. He put Melanie in the back seat and fastened the belt across her lap. From the front seat, Laura glanced back and was startled by her daughter's appearance. In the closed garage, illuminated only by the car's ceiling light, the girl's gaunt face was fleshed out by shadows. The harsh lines and sharp bones were softened by the moon-pale glow. For the first time, Laura realized how very pretty her little girl would be when she had gained some weight. She would be utterly and miraculously transformed by a few pounds and by peace of mind, both of which would come with time. Abruptly, Laura was able to see the potential within the battered clay, the familiar within the alien, the beauty within the grayness. "Time, like a painter's brush, would layer other experiences and emotions over Melanie's now bright agony, and when the paint of days and weeks and years had become sufficiently thick to all but conceal the horror of her ordeal with her father, she would no longer be a skeletal, angular, strange creature with death-pale skin and wounded eyes. She would, in fact, be quite lovely. That realization made Laura's breath catch, and it renewed her hope. More important, the kind light and caressing shadows allowed her to perceive much of herself in her daughter, and that perception had an even more profound effect on her. Intellectually, she had known that Melanie resembled her. Evidence in her genes was clear in the child's haunted face, in spite of the abuse that had pulled it into a tortured mask. But until now, she had not quite related to that likeness on a deep emotional level. Seeing herself in her daughter, she had a more intense awareness that her child's suffering was her own suffering, that her child's future was her own future, and that she could have no happiness until Melanie was happy too. Whereas the realization of the girl's underlying beauty had renewed Laura's hope, this second insight renewed her determination to find the truth and to beat their enemies, even if the whole damned world was aligned against them. Errol got behind the wheel. He looked over at Laura and said, "It's going to get a little wild for the next few minutes." "It's already gotten wild," she said, buckling her seatbelt. "I've had a driving course that teaches avoidance of terrorists and kidnappers, so I'm not being as reckless as it's going to seem." "Recklessness won't bother me in the least," she said. "Not after seeing that wind thing smash its way into my kitchen. Besides, I've always thought it would be a lot of fun to drive like James Bond." He smiled at her. "You've got grit." As he started the engine, she picked up the automatic garage door opener that lay on the console tray between the seats. He said, "Now." Laura pressed the button on the remote control device, and the garage door started to swing up. Before the door had lifted all the way, Earl threw the car into reverse and backed under it with only an inch to spare, moving fast. Laura expected to crash through the rising door, but they slipped out of the garage and reversed away from the house at high speed. They slowed where the driveway met the street, but not much, and Earl pulled the steering wheel hard right so they were facing down the long hill. The FBI, in its fake telephone company van, had not yet reacted. Earl hit the brakes, shifted the Honda out of reverse into drive, and jammed his foot down on the accelerator. Tires squealed, and the car seemed to stick to the pavement, but then they rocked forward down the dark and sloping street. Two blocks downhill, Earl glanced at the rearview mirror and said, "They're coming." Laura looked through the rear window and saw the van just pulling away from the curb. Earl tapped the brakes and swung the steering wheel hard to the right, and the Honda half-turned, half-slid around the corner into the cross street. At the next intersection, he turned left, then right again at the end of that block, speeding and weaving through the quiet residential neighborhood, finally out of Sherman Oaks altogether, to the top of the valley wall, over the ridgeline, into Benedict Canyon and down the forested slopes, through the darkness toward the distant light of Beverly Hills and Los Angeles beyond. "We've lost them," he said happily. Laura was not completely relieved. She wasn't convinced that they could lose their inhuman enemy, the unseen It, as easily as they had shaken the FBI van. Chapter 25. Dan watched Regine closely, trying to figure how he could force her to tell him what she knew. She was so pliable that he could surely bend her to his purposes if he could only determine how and where to apply pressure. Regine was no longer biting on her knuckle. She had slipped a thumb into her mouth and gently sucked on it. Her pose was so provocative, innocence waiting to be despoiled, that he was certain it was something that Huffritz had taught her to do. Something he had programmed her to do. But it was clear that she also was soothed by the thumb-sucking. Her inner torment was so severe that it had driven her to seek solace in the simplest, most infantile rituals of reassurance. From the moment that she had put her thumb in her mouth, she had stopped sitting erect and ladylike. Now she slumped into the corner of the sofa. The neckline of her robe had parted, revealing deep, smooth, shadowed cleavage. Dan had a pretty good idea how to make her talk, but he didn't like doing what he would have to do. She took her thumb out of her mouth long enough to say, "I can't help you, I really can't. Will you go now? Please?" He didn't answer. He got up from the armchair, walked around the coffee table, and stood over her, frowning down at her. She kept her head bowed. Sternly, almost harshly, he said, "Look at me." She looked at him. In a tremulous voice that indicated she expected to be ignored, she said, "Will you go now? Please, will you go now?" "You're going to answer my questions, Regine," he said, scowling at her. "You're not going to lie to me. If you won't answer, or if you lie to me..."
"Will you hit me?"
she asked. He was confronted not by a woman any longer, but by a sick, lost, miserable creature. Not a frightened creature, however. The prospect of being struck did not fill her with terror. Quite the opposite. She was sick, lost, miserable, and hungry, hungry for the thrill of being hit, starving for the pleasure of pain. Repressing his revulsion, making his voice as cold as he could, he said, "I won't hit you. I won't touch you. But you'll tell me what I want to know, because that's the reason you exist right now." Her eyes shone with a curious light, like those of an animal seen at night. "You always do what's wanted of you, right? You are what you're expected to be. I expect you to be cooperative, Regine. I want you to answer my questions, and you will, because that's the only damn thing you're good for, answering questions." She stared up at him expectantly. "Have you ever met Ernest Andrew Cooper?"
"No."
"You're lying."
"Am I?"
Suppressing all the sympathy and compassion he felt for her, he made his voice even colder, and he raised one fist over her, although he had no intention of using it. "Do you know Cooper?" She didn't answer, but her eyes focused on his big fist with an unholy adoration that he couldn't bear to contemplate. With sudden inspiration, he feigned an anger that he didn't feel and said, "Answer me, you bitch!" She flinched at the derogatory address, but not because it hurt or surprised her. She flinched instead, as if a shock of delight had passed through her. Even that meager verbal abuse had been a key that unlocked her. Gazing at his fist, she said,
"Please."
"Maybe."
"You'd like to."
"Maybe, if you tell me what I want to know. Cooper."
"They don't tell me their last names. I knew an Ernie somebody, but I don't know if it was Cooper."
He described the dead millionaire.
"Yeah," she said, her gaze shifting between his fist and his eyes. "That was him."
"You met him through Willie?"
"Yes."
"And Joseph Scaldone?"
"Willie introduced me to this guy named Joe, but I never knew his last name either."
"Dan described Joseph Scaldone." She nodded.
"That was him."
"And Ned Rink?"
"I don't think I ever met him."
"A short, stocky, rather ugly man." As he fleshed out that description, she began to shake her head.
"No, I never met that one."
"You've seen the Grey Room?"
"Yes, I dream of it sometimes, of sitting in that chair, and they do it to me, the shocks, the electricity."
"When did you see it, the room, the chair?"
"Oh, a few years ago, when they were first painting the room, putting in the equipment, getting it ready."
"What were they doing with Melanie McCaffrey?"
"I don't know."
"Don't lie to me, damn it. You are what you're expected to be, and you do what's wanted of you. Always what's wanted of you, so cut the shit and answer me."
"No, really, I don't know," she said meekly. "Willie never told me. It was secret, an important secret. It had changed the world, he said. That's all I know. He didn't include me in those things very much. His life with me was separate from his work with those other men."
Dan continued to stand over her, and she continued to cower in a corner of the sofa. And although the threat he posed to her was entirely theatrical, he nevertheless felt uncomfortably like a bully. "What did the occult have to do with their experiments?"
"I haven't any idea."
"Did Willie believe in the supernatural?"
"No."
"Why do you say that?"
"Well, because Dylan McCaffrey believed indiscriminately in it, all of it, ghosts and seances and even goblins, for all I know. And Willie used to make fun of him, said he was gullible."
"Then why was he working with McCaffrey?"
Willie thought Dylan was a genius.
In spite of his superstitions?
Yeah.
Who was funding them, Regine?
I don't know.
She moved in such a way that her robe parted further, revealing more cleavage, most of one full breast. Come on, he said impatiently. Who's been paying their bills? Who, Regine?
I swear, I don't know.
He sat on the couch beside her. He took her by the chin, held her face, not gently, not with erotic intention, but as an extension of the threat first embodied by his raised fist. Meaningless as the threat was, she nevertheless responded to it. This was what she wanted. To be intimidated, to be commanded, and to obey. Who? He repeated.
She said, I don't know. I really, really don't. I'd tell you if I did, I swear. Anything you want, I'd tell you.
This time he believed her. But he didn't let go of her face. I know Melanie McCaffrey endured a lot of mental and physical abuse in that gray room. But I want to know. Christ, I don't want to know, but I've got to know. Was there sexual abuse, too? Regine's mouth was somewhat compressed by his grip on her chin and jaws, so her voice was slightly distorted.
How would I know?
You would have known, he insisted. One way or the other, you would have sensed a thing like that, even if Hoffertz didn't talk to you much about what went on in Studio City. He might not have talked about what he was trying to achieve with the girl, but he would have bragged about his control of her. I'm sure of that. I never met him, but I know him well enough to be sure of that.
I don't believe there was anything sexual about it, Regine said.
He squeezed her face, and she winced, but he saw with dismay that she liked it nonetheless, so he relaxed his hand, though he didn't let go of her. Are you sure?
Almost certain. He might have liked to have her, but I think you're right. He would have told me that if he'd done it, if he'd been with her like that.
Did he even hint at it?
No.
Dan was profoundly relieved. He even smiled. At least the child hadn't been subjected to that indignity. Then he remembered one indignity she had endured, and his smile quickly died. He let go of Regine's face, but stayed beside her on the couch. Gradually fading red spots marked where his fingers had pressed into her tender skin. Regine, you said you hadn't seen Willie in more than a year. Why? She lowered her eyes, bent her neck. Her shoulders softened even more, and she slumped farther into the corner of the sofa. Why? He repeated.
Willie got tired of me.
That she should care so much about Willie made Dan ill. He didn't want me anymore, she said in a tone of voice more suited to announcing imminent death from cancer. Willie not wanting her anymore was clearly the worst, most devastating development that she could imagine.
I did everything. Anything. But nothing was enough.
He just broke it off? Cold?
I never saw him after he sent me away. But we talked on the phone now and then. We had to.
Had to talk on the phone? About what? Almost whispering.
About the others he sent around to see me.
What others?
His friends. The other men.
He sent men to you?
Yes.
For sex?
For sex. For anything they wanted. I'd do anything they want. For Willie.
Dan's mental image of the late Wilhelm Hoffritz was growing more monstrous by the minute. The man had been a viper. He not only brainwashed and established control of Regine for his own sexual gratification, but even after he no longer wanted her, he continued to control her and abuse her secondhand. Apparently, the mere fact that she continued to be abused, even beyond his sight, gratified him sufficiently to maintain an iron grip on her tortured mind. He had been a singularly sick man, worse than sick, demented. Regine raised her head and said, not without enthusiasm,
"Do you want me to tell you some of the things they made me do?"
Dan stared at her, speechless with revulsion.
"I don't mind telling you," she assured him. "You might enjoy hearing. I didn't mind doing those things, and I don't mind telling you exactly what I did."
"No," he said hoarsely.
You might like to hear.
No. She giggled softly.
It might give you some ideas.
Shut up, he said, and he nearly slapped her. She bowed her head as if she were a dog that had been cowed by a scolding master. He said, The men Hufford sent to you. Who were they?
I only know their first names. One of them was Andy, and you've told me his last name was Cooper. Another one was Joe.
Scaldone? Who else?
Howard. Shelby. Eddie.
Eddie who?
I told you I don't know their last names.
How often did they come?
Most of them once or twice a week.
They still come here?
Oh, sure. I'm what they need. There was only one guy who came once and never came back.
What was his name?
Albert.
Albert Ulander?
I don't know.
What did he look like?
Tall, thin, with a bony face. I don't know how else to describe him. I guess you'd say he sort of looked like a hawk. Hawkish. Sharp features.
Dan hadn't looked at the author's photograph and the books now in the trunk of his car, but he intended to do so when he left Regine. He said, Albert, Howard, Shelby, Eddie, anybody else?
Well, like I said, Andy and Joe, but they're dead now, huh?
Very.
And there's one other man. He comes by all the time. But I don't even know his first name.
What's he look like?
About 6 foot. Distinguished, beautiful white hair, beautiful clothes. Not handsome, you know, but elegant. He carries himself so well, and he speaks very well. He's cultured. I like him. He hurts me so beautifully.
Dan took a deep breath. If you don't even know his first name, what do you call him?
She grinned. Oh, there's only one thing he wants me to call him. She looked mischievous, winked at Dan. Daddy.
What?
I call him Daddy, always. I pretend he's my daddy, see, and he pretends I'm really his daughter. And I sit on his lap, and we talk about school, and I...
That's enough, he said, feeling as if he had stepped into a corner of hell, where knowing the local customs was an obligation to live by them. He preferred not knowing. He wanted to sweep the photographs off the table, smash the glass that shielded them, pull the other pictures off the mantel and throw them in the fireplace and light them with a match. But he knew that he would be of no help to Regine merely by destroying those reminders of Hufford's. The hateful man was dead, yes, but he would live for years in this woman's mind, like a malevolent troll in a secret cave. Dan touched her face again, but briefly and tenderly this time. Regine... What do you do with your time, your days, your life? She shrugged. Do you go to movies, dancing, out to dinner with friends, or do you just sit here waiting for someone to need you?
Mostly I stay here, she said. I like it here. This is where Willie wanted me.
And what do you do for a living?
I do what they want.
You've got a degree in psychology, for God's sake.
She said nothing.
Why did you finish your degree at UCLA if you didn't intend to use it?
Willie wanted me to finish. It was funny, you know. They threw him out. Those bastards at the university, but they couldn't throw me out so easily. I was there to remind them about Willie. That pleased him. He thought that was a terrific joke.
You could do important work, interesting work.
I'm doing what I was made for.
No, you aren't. You're doing what Hufford said you were made for. That's very different.
Willie knew, she said. Willie knew everything.
Willie was a rotten pig, he said.
No.
Tears formed in her eyes again. So they come here and use you, hurt you. He grabbed her arm, pulled up the sleeve of her robe, revealing the bruise that he had spotted earlier, and the rope burns at her wrist. They hurt you, don't they?
Yeah, in one way or another. Some of them more than others. Some of them are better at it. Some of them make it feel so sweet.
Why do you put up with it?
I like it.
The air seemed even more oppressive than it had a few minutes ago. Thick, moist, heavy with a grime that couldn't be seen, a filth that settled not on the skin, but on the soul. Dan didn't want to breathe it in. It was dangerously corrupting air. "Who pays your rent?" he asked.
"There is no rent."
"Who owns the house?"
"A company."
"What company?"
"What can I do for you?"
"What company?"
"Let me do something for you."
"What company?" he persisted.
"John Wilkes Enterprises."
"Who's John Wilkes?"
"I don't know."
"You've never had a man here named John?"
"No."
"How do you know about this John Wilkes Enterprises?"
"I get a check from them every month. A very nice check."
Shakily, Dan got to his feet. Regine was visibly disappointed. He looked around, spotted the suitcases by the door, which he had noticed when he'd first come in. "Going away?"
"For a few days."
"Where?"
"Las Vegas."
"Are you running, Regine?"
"What would I be running from?"
"People are getting killed because of what happened in that gray room."
"But I don't know what happened in the gray room, and I don't care," she said, "so I'm safe."
Staring down at her, Dan realized that Regine Savannah Hoffritz had a gray room all of her own. She carried it with her wherever she went. For her gray room was where the real Regine was locked away, trapped, imprisoned. He said, "Regine, you need help.
I need to be what you want."
"No, you need..."
"I'm fine."
"You need counseling."
"I'm free. Willie taught me how to be free."
"Free from what?"
"Responsibility. Fear. Hope. Free from everything."
"Willie didn't free you. He enslaved you."
"You don't understand.
He was a sadist."
"There's nothing wrong with that."
"He got inside your mind. Twisted you. We're not talking about some half-baked psychology professor, Regine. This lunatic was a heavyweight. This was a guy who worked for the Pentagon, researching behavior modification, developing new methods of brainwashing. Ego-repressing drugs, Regine. Subliminal persuasion. Willie was to Big Brother what Merlin was to King Arthur. Except Willie did bad magic, Regine. He transformed you into a masochist for his amusement."
"And that's how he freed me," she said serenely.
"You see, when you no longer fear pain, when you learn to love pain, then you can't be afraid of anything anymore.
That's why I'm free."
Dan wanted to shake her, but he knew that shaking her would do no good. Quite the opposite. She would only beg for more. He wanted to get her in front of a sympathetic judge and have her committed without her consent so she could receive psychiatric treatment. But he wasn't related to her. He was virtually a stranger to her. No judge would play along with him. It just wasn't done that way. There seemed to be nothing he could do for her. She said,
"You know something interesting? I think maybe Willie's not really dead."
"Oh, he's dead, all right."
"Maybe not.
I saw the body. We got a positive ID match from dental records and fingerprints."
"Maybe," she said, "but, well, I get the feeling he's still alive. Sometimes I sense him out there. I feel him. It's strange. I can't explain it, but that's why I'm not as broken up as I might have been, because I'm not convinced he's dead. Somehow, he's still out there."
Her self-image and her primary reasons for continuing to live were so dependent upon Willie Hoffritz, upon the prospect of receiving his praise and his approval, or at least upon hearing his voice on the telephone every once in a while, that she was never going to be able to accept his death. Dan suspected that he could take her to the morgue, confront her with the bloody corpse, force her to place her hands upon the cold, dead flesh, make her stare into the grotesquely battered countenance,
shove the coroner's report in front of her, and nevertheless fail to convince her that Hufford had been killed. Hufford had gotten inside her, had shattered her psyche, then had rejoined the pieces in a pattern that was more pleasing to himself, with himself as the bonding agent holding her together. If Regina accepted the reality of his death, there would be no glue binding her any more, and she might collapse into insanity. Her only hope, or so it must seem to her, was to believe that Willie was still alive.
"Yes, he's out there," she said again. "I feel it. Somehow, somewhere, he's out there."
Feeling utterly ineffectual, loathing his powerlessness, Dan headed toward the door. Behind him, Regine rose quickly from the sofa and said, "Please, wait." He glanced back at her. She said,
"You could have me."
"No, Regine.
Do anything to me."
"No.
I'll be your animal."
He continued to the door. She said,
"Your little animal."
He resisted the urge to run. She caught up with him as he opened the door. Her perfume was subtle but effective. She put one hand on his shoulder and said,
"I like you."
"Where are your folks, Regine?"
"You make me hot."
"Your mother and father, where do they live?" She put her slender fingers to his lips. They were warm. She traced the outline of his mouth. He pushed her hand away. She said,
"I really, really like you."
"Maybe your folks could help you through this."
"I like you."
"Regine."
"Hurt me. Hurt me very badly."
He pushed her away from him as a compassionate hypochondriac might push away a grasping leper, firmly, with distaste, with fear of contagion, but with a regard for the delicacy of her condition.
She said, "When Willie put me in the hospital, he came to visit me every day. He arranged a private room for me and always closed the door when he came so we'd be alone. When we were alone, he kissed my bruises. Every day, he came and kissed my bruises. You can't know how good his lips felt on my bruises, Lieutenant. One kiss, and each spot of soreness, each little tender contusion was transformed. Instead of pain, each bruise was filled with pleasure. It was as if a clitoris sprang up in the place of every bruise, and when he kissed me, I climaxed again and again."
Dan got the hell out of there and slammed the door behind him. Chapter 26. With a cold and gusty wind blowing scraps of litter along the night streets, and with the portent of rain heavy in the air, Earl Benton took Laura and Melanie to an apartment on the first floor of a rambling three-story complex in Westwood, south of Wiltshire Boulevard. It had a living room, a dining alcove, a kitchen, one bedroom, and one bath. The place didn't seem quite as small as it actually was, because big windows looked out on a lushly landscaped courtyard which, at that time of night, was illuminated by blue and green filtered spotlights concealed throughout the shrubbery. The apartment was owned by California Paladin and was used as a safe house. The agency was occasionally hired to retrieve teenagers and college-age kids from fanatical religious cults with which they had become entangled. Immediately upon being freed, they were brought to that apartment where they underwent several days of deprogramming before returning to their parents. The safe house also had been used as a secure way station for wives who were threatened by estranged husbands, and on several occasions, high corporate executives in a variety of industries had met there for days at a time to plan secret and hostile takeover bids of other companies because they could be free of worry about electronic eavesdropping and corporate espionage. California Paladin had also once stashed a Baptist minister in those rooms after a youth gang in south-central L.A. had put out a contract on his life to repay him for testimony against one of their brothers. A rock music star had passed through while dodging a particularly onerous subpoena in an expensive civil suit. And a big-name actress had needed just this degree of total privacy in just such an unlikely location as this in order to recuperate from secret cancer surgery that, if revealed, would have cost her roles in upcoming pictures,
Producers were reluctant to hire stars who would be ineligible for completion bonds and who might get sick or even die halfway through filming. Melanie and Laura would make use of those quiet, modest rooms at least for the night. Laura hoped that the hideaway would be as safe from the strange force pursuing them as it was from youth gangs and process servers. Earl turned on the heat and went into the kitchen to brew a pot of coffee. Laura tried to interest Melanie in some hot chocolate, but the girl wanted none. Melanie moved like a sleepwalker to the largest chair in the living room, climbed onto it, curled her legs beneath her, and sat staring down at her hands, which lethargically pulled and rubbed and scratched and massaged each other. Her fingers interlaced and knotted and then untied themselves and then knotted together again. She stared at her hands so raptly that it almost began to seem as if she didn't realize that they were a part of her, but thought instead that they were two small, busy animals at play in her lap. The coffee countered the chill they had gotten while coming from the windswept parking lot to the apartment, but it couldn't relieve that other chill, the one caused not by physical stimuli, but by their unexpected and unwanted encounter with the unknown. While Earl called his office to report their move from the house in Sherman Oaks, Laura stood at the living room window, holding the coffee mug in both hands, breathing in the fragrant vapors. As she stared out at the lakes of shadow, at the sprays and pools of green and blue light, the first fat droplets of rain began to snap against the palm fronds. Somewhere in the night, something was stalking Melanie. Something beyond human understanding, an invulnerable creature that left its victims looking as if they had gone through half the cycle in a trash compactor before someone had pushed the emergency stop button. Laura's university degrees, her doctorate in psychology, might make it possible for her to eventually bring Melanie out of quasi-autistic withdrawal, but nothing taught and nothing learned in any university could help her deal with it. Was it demon spirit? Psychic force? Those things didn't exist, right? Did not exist. Yet, what had Dylan and Hoffritz unleashed? And why? Dylan had believed in the supernatural. Periodically he had been obsessed with one aspect of the occult or another, and during those periods he had been more intense and nervous and argumentative than usual. In fact, when thus obsessed, he reminded Laura of her mother because his adamant belief in and constant preaching about the reality of the occult was akin to the religious fanaticism and superstitious mania that had made Beatrice such a terror. It was this, as much as anything, that had driven Laura to divorce. For she could not abide anything that reminded her of her fear-ridden childhood. Now, she tried to remember specific enthusiasms that had gripped Dylan, theories that had obsessed him. She strove to recall something that might explain what was happening now, but she could not remember anything important, because she had always refused to listen to him when he had spoken of those things that had seemed to her like the sheerest flights of fancy, or madness. In reaction to her mother's irrationality and gullibility, Laura had built a life strictly on logic and reason, trusting in only those things that she could see, hear, touch, smell, and feel. She did not believe that a cracked mirror meant 7 years of bad luck, and she did not throw spilled salt over her shoulder. Given the choice, she would always walk under a ladder rather than around it, merely to prove that there was nothing of her mother in her. She didn't believe in devils, demons, possession, and exorcism. In her heart, she felt there was a God, but she didn't attend church or identify with any particular religion. She didn't read ghost stories, had no interest in movies about vampires and werewolves. She didn't believe in psychics, premonitions, clairvoyant visions. She was profoundly unprepared for the events of the past 24 hours. While logic and reason made the most solid foundation on which to construct a life, she realized that the mortar ought to be mixed with a sense of wonder, with a respect for the unknown, or at least leavened with open-mindedness. Otherwise it would be brittle mortar that would dry, crack, and flake away. Her mother's extreme reliance on religion and superstition was undoubtedly sick. But perhaps it wasn't wise to have rushed to the other extreme of the philosophical spectrum. The universe seemed considerably more complicated than it had been before. Something was out there. Something she couldn't understand. And it wanted Melanie. But even as she stood by the window and studied the rainy night, with a new respect for things mysterious and uncanny, her mind sought more rational explanations, tangible villains of flesh and blood. She heard Earl talking on the telephone with someone at his office, and suddenly it occurred to her that no one except California Paladin knew where she and her daughter were. For a terrible moment, she felt that she had done something very wrong, very stupid, in allowing herself to be spirited away from the watchful eyes of the FBI, from contact with friends and neighbors and the police. Melanie had not been targeted solely by the unseen it of which they had been warned, but by real people, too. People like that hired killer who had been found in the hospital parking lot. And what if those people had contacts inside California Paladin? What if Earl himself was the executioner? Stop! She took a deep breath. Another. She was standing on a slope of slippery emotions, sliding toward hysteria. For Melanie's sake, if not her own, she had to maintain control of herself. Chapter 27. Dan stepped out of Regine's house and slammed the door behind him. But he didn't head down the walk. He waited, listening at the door, and his suspicion was confirmed when he heard a man's voice. She hadn't been alone. The man was furious. He shouted, and she called him Eddie and responded in a meek and wheedling voice. The flat, hard, unmistakable sound of a slap was followed by her cry, a bleat composed partly of pain, partly of fear, but also partly of pleasure and excitement. Around Dan, the wind huffed noisily and the branches of the trees were scraped against one another, and it wasn't possible to hear exactly what was being said in the house. He picked up enough words to know that Eddie was angry because Regine had revealed too much. In a miserable, servile voice, Regine tried to explain that she'd had no choice but to tell Dan what she knew. Dan hadn't asked for answers, he had demanded answers. And more important, he had demanded in a way that pushed all her buttons. She was an obedient creature who found meaning, purpose, and joy only in doing what she was told to do. Eddie and his friends liked her that way, she said. Wanted her that way, she said. And it wasn't possible for her to be that way with them and not that way with other people. Don't you understand, Eddie? Don't you understand? He might have understood, but her explanation did nothing to ameliorate his fury. He slapped her again. Again, and her tortured but dismayingly eager cry did not bear contemplation. Dan moved away from the door, along the front of the house, to the first window. He wanted to get a look at Eddie. Through a gap in the drapes, he saw a portion of the living room and a man of about 45. The guy had red hair, a mustache, and doughy features. He was dressed in black slacks, white shirt, gray sweater vest, and bow tie. His face was that of an aging, spoiled child. He had an effete quality, and he moved with a bantam rooster strut that wasn't natural to him, as if he thought that authority must always be expressed by a puffing of the chest, a rolling of the shoulders, and a cocky attitude. In spite of his posturing, he looked weak and ineffectual, like a wimpy high school English teacher who had trouble controlling his students. He was not at all the kind of man who would slap a woman around. Very likely he would not have been slapping Regine if she'd been any other woman than she was. For another woman might have slapped him back. More than anything else, Eddie was distressed that Regine had told Dan about John Wilkes Enterprises, the company that was her keeper, that owned the house in which she lived, and that sent her a check each month. Regine was on her knees before him, head bowed, like a vassal humbling herself before her feudal lord. And he loomed over her, shifting from foot to foot, gesticulating with nervous energy, repeatedly castigating her for having such a loose tongue. John Wilkes Enterprises. Dan knew he had been given another key to another lock in this many-doored mystery. He turned away from the house and returned to the street where he had parked the car. He opened the trunk and plucked one of the 7 Albert Uhlender books from the carton that he had carried out of Ned Rink's house earlier in the evening. Regine had said that a man named Albert had visited her once, and unlike the others who used her, had never visited her again. She had said that he'd had a bony face with sharp features, hawk-like. Now, in the ghostly radiance of a mercury vapor streetlight, and in the even more eldritch glow of the bulb in the car's trunk, Dan studied the photograph of the author on the book jacket. Uhlender's face was long, narrow, almost cadaverous, with prominent brow, cheekbones, and jawline. His eyes were cold and predatory, at least in the context of his hooked and beakish nose. And he did indeed have the aspect of a hawk, or some other ferocious bird of prey. So it had been Uhlender who had visited Regine, but only on one occasion, not motivated by overpowering and perverse sexual needs as were the others, but perhaps by curiosity, as if he needed to see for himself that she was real and that Hoffritz had thoroughly enslaved her. Maybe Uhlender had wished to satisfy himself as to Hoffritz's genius in these matters before joining him and Dylan McCaffrey on the strange project that they had undertaken with Melanie. Whatever the case, Dan wanted to talk to him. He added Uhlender to the mental list of those whom he intended to question, a list that already included Mary O'Hara, Ernest Andrew Cooper's wife, Joseph Scaldone's wife, if he had one, the executives and or owners of John Wilkes Enterprises, the silver-haired and distinguished pervert who visited Regine regularly and whom she knew only as Daddy, and the other men who used her, Eddie, Shelby, and Howard. He put the book back in the carton, closed the trunk, and got into the car just as a few fat drops of rain began to splatter the pavement. Scaldone's mailing list was still in his pocket, and he was certain that he would soon find last names for Eddie, Shelby, and Howard among those 300 customers of the Sign of the Pentagram. The light there was poor, however, and he was tired, and his eyes felt sandy, and he still wanted to talk to Laura McCaffrey before it got too late, so he left the list in his pocket, started the engine, and drove out of the Hollywood Hills. At 10:44, when he reached Laura's house in Sherman Oaks, a cold rain was falling. Although lights were on in several rooms, no one answered the door. He rang the bell, then knocked, then pounded on the door, to no avail. Where was Earl Benton? He was supposed to remain there until midnight, when another agent from California Paladin was scheduled to relieve him. Dan thought of the crushed and disfigured corpses in Studio City the previous night, and he thought of the dead hitman, Ned Rink, and with growing anxiety, he moved away from the door, squished across the wet lawn, pushed between 2 flower-laden hibiscus bushes, and peered in the nearest window. He saw nothing out of the ordinary, no bodies or blood or wreckage. He went to the next window, and still he saw nothing, so he hurried to the gate at the side of the house and went through it and along the walk to the rear, his heart racing and an ulcerous pain flaring in his gut. The kitchen door was unlocked. As he pushed it open and stepped inside, he noted that the door frame was splintered and that a ruined security chain hung from its mounting. Then he saw the mess in the room beyond, torn and wilted flowers, shredded and wadded leaves, other greenery, clods of moist earth. No blood. On the table were 3 unfinished spaghetti dinners, speckled with dirt and debris. 1 overturned chair. A tangled mass of impatience bristled from the sink. But no blood. Thank God. No blood. So far. He drew his revolver. Full of dread, with incipient grief welling in anticipation of the battered corpses that must lie somewhere in the house, he edged out of the kitchen and moved cautiously from one room to the next. He found nothing but a wary cat that dashed away from him. Checking the garage, he saw that Laura McCaffrey's blue Honda was gone. He didn't know what to make of that. When he uncovered no bodies anywhere, his relief was as great as if he had been trudging along an ocean floor with billions of tons of water pressing on him and was now abruptly transported to dry land where only air weighed on his shoulders. The extent and depth of his relief, and the great exhilaration that accompanied it, forced him to admit to himself that his feelings for this woman and her troubled child were different from his feelings for all the other victims whom he had known in 14 years of police work. Nor could his unusual involvement and empathy be attributed to the vague parallels between this case and that of Fran and Cindy Lakey years ago. He wasn't drawn to Laura McCaffrey solely because, by saving her and Melanie, he could atone for his failure to save Cindy Lakey's life. That was part of it, certainly, but he was also attracted to this woman. The influence that she had on him was not quite like anything he'd ever known before. He was drawn to her not only because of her beauty, which was undeniably affecting, and not only because of her intelligence, which was important to him, since he had never shared most men's fascination with dumb blondes and airhead brunettes, but also because of her incredible strength and determination in the face of horror and adversity. But even if she and Melanie get out of this predicament alive, Dan thought, there's probably little hope of a relationship between her and me. She's a doctor of psychology, for God's sake. I'm a cop. She's better educated than I am. She makes more money than I do. Forget it, Haldane. You're out of your class. Nevertheless, when he found no bodies anywhere in the house, he was immensely relieved, and his heart swelled with a particular joy that he wouldn't have felt if the escapees from death had been any other escapees than this woman and her daughter. When he returned to the kitchen to have a closer look at the wreckage there, Dan found that he was no longer alone in the house. Michael Seams, the FBI agent he'd met a few hours ago at the sign of the Pentagram, was standing by the table, hands in the pockets of his raincoat, studying the floral debris that filled the room. Beneath his graying hair, above his apparently aged shoulders, a troubled and puzzled expression lay upon Seams's anachronistically young face. "Where have they gone?" Dan asked. "I was hoping you could tell me," Seams said. "At my suggestion, she hired around-the-clock bodyguards. California Paladin." "Yeah, that's right. But as far as I know, they weren't going to recommend that you go into hiding or anything like that. They were going to stay here with her. One of them was here, an Earl Benton." "Yes, I know him. Until about an hour ago, then without warning, he split with Laura McCaffrey and the girl, went out of here like a bat out of hell. We have a surveillance van across the street." "Oh? They tried to follow Benton, but he was moving too fast." Seams frowned. "In fact, it seemed like he was trying to give us a slip as much as anything else. You have any idea why he'd want to do that?"
"Just a wild guess. I'm probably totally off the wall to even suggest it. But maybe he doesn't trust you."
"We're here to protect the child. You sure our government wouldn't like to have her for a while? To try to figure out what McCaffrey and Hoffertz were doing with her in that gray room?"
"We might," Seams admitted. "That decision hasn't been made yet, but this is America, you know."
"So I've heard.
And we wouldn't kidnap her."
"What would you call it? Borrowing her?"
"We'd want to have her mother's permission for whatever tests we'd run."
Dan sighed, not sure what to believe. Seams said,
"You didn't maybe tell Benton that he should get them out from under us, did you?"
"Why would I do that? I'm a public servant, same as you."
"Then you always work these hours, all day and half the night? And every case you handle?"
"Not every case."
"Most cases?"
Dan could honestly say, "Yeah, in fact, on most cases I put in long hours. You get going on an investigation, and one thing leads to another, and it isn't always possible to stop cold at 5 o'clock each day. Most detectives work long hours, irregular shifts. You must know that."
"You work harder than most, I hear."
Dan shrugged. Seams said,
"They say you're a bulldog, that you love your work and you really sink your teeth into it, really hang on."
"Maybe. I guess I work pretty hard. But in a homicide, the trail can get cold fast. Usually, if you don't get a lead on your killer in 3 or 4 days, you'll never hang it on anyone."
"But you're putting more into this case than even the average homicide detective usually does. More than even you usually do, aren't you, Lieutenant?"
"Maybe."
"You know you are."
"Arf, arf."
"What?"
"The bulldog in me."
"Why such a bulldog on this case?"
"I guess I was just in the mood for some action."
"That's no answer.
I just ate too much Purina dog chow. Have too much energy. Got to work it off.
Seems shook his head. It's because you've got a special stake in this one.
Do I?
Don't you?
Not that I'm aware of, Dan said, although an image of Laura McCaffrey's lovely face rose unbidden in his memory. Seems regarded him with suspicion and said, Mason Haldane, if someone was bankrolling McCaffrey and Hoffritz because their project had a military application, then those same, let's call them financiers, those same financiers might be willing to spread a lot of money around to get their hands on the girl again. But any money they spread would be dirty, damned dirty. Any guy who took it would probably come down with an infection from it, know what I mean? At first it had appeared that Seams was somehow aware of Dan's romantic inclinations toward Laura. Now it was suddenly clear that a darker worry nagged the agent. For God's sake, Dan thought, he's wondering if I've sold out to the Russians or someone. Jesus, Seams, are you ever on the wrong track? They might be willing to pay a lot to get their hands on her, and while a police detective is reasonably well paid in this city, he's never going to get rich, unless he moonlights. I resent the implication, and I regret your reluctance to make a plain denial of that implication. No, I haven't sold out to anyone, anywhere, at any time. No, yet. Negative. Definitely not. Is that plain enough for you? Seams didn't answer. Instead, he said, Anyway, when their surveillance team lost Benton, they drove right back here to wait, to see if the woman and girl would return or whether maybe somebody else would show up. As an afterthought, they came to have a look around the house, found the door the way you found it, and this weird mess. Dan said, What about the mess? What do you make of it? The flowers are from the garden in the back. But what are they doing here? Who brought them inside? We can't figure it. And why has the security chain been torn out of the door? Looks like somebody forced their way inside, Seams said. Really? Gee, you bureau guys don't miss a trick. I'm at a loss to understand your attitude. So is everyone else. Your lack of cooperation. I'm just a very bad boy. Dan went to the telephone, and Seams wanted to know what he was doing, and Dan said, Calling Paladin. If Earl felt Laura and Melanie were in danger here, he might have moved them in a hurry the way you say he did. But when he got wherever he was going, he'd call his office and tell them where he was. The night operator at California Paladin, Lonnie Beamer, knew Dan well enough to recognize his voice. Yeah, Lieutenant, Earl took them to the safe house. Lonnie seemed to think Dan knew the address of that place, which he didn't. Earl had spoken of it a few times when he'd been telling tales about various cases on which he'd worked. But if he had ever said exactly where the safe house was, Dan had forgotten. He couldn't ask Lonnie Beamer for the address without alerting Seams, who was watching intently. He'd have to call the night operator again from another phone, once he had slipped away from the FBI agent. On the phone, Lonnie said, But they probably won't be there much longer. Why not? Haven't you heard? Mrs. McCaffrey and the kid won't be needing our protection anymore. Though she hasn't decided to let us go just yet, she may want us to hang around, too, but for the most part, you people are taking over for us. You're giving them police protection. Are you serious?
Yeah, Lonnie said. Around-the-clock police protection. Right now, Earl's over there in Westwood at the safe house waiting for a couple of your people to show up and take the McCaffreys off his hands. They'll probably be there any minute.
Who?
Let's see. Captain Mondale ordered the protection, and Earl's been told to relinquish our clients to Detectives Wexlers and Manuelo.
Something was wrong. Very wrong. The department was too short-handed to provide around-the-clock protection, even in a case like this. And Ross wouldn't have called Paladin himself. That was always delegated to assistants. Besides, if protection were to be offered, it would be in the form of uniformed officers, not vitally needed plain-clothed detectives who were in even shorter supply than patrolmen. And why Wexlers and Manuelo in particular?
So you might as well stay there in Sherman Oaks, Lonnie said, because I imagine your people would bring the McCaffrey straight back there.
Dan wanted to know more, but he couldn't talk freely with Seams breathing down his neck. He said,
Well, thanks anyway, Lonnie, but I think it's inexcusable that you don't know where your operative is or what's happening to your clients.
Huh? But I just said he was...
I've always thought Paladin was the best. But if you can't keep track of your agents and your clients, especially clients whose lives might be in jeopardy... Lonnie said,
what's wrong with you, Haldane?
Sure, sure.